Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast, with over 6 million unique listeners in 177 countries. This is Jason Henricks with regular commentator Penny Crossman from American Banker. We're into a full year of open banking, and I dare say that we're still figuring out what that means. On today's show, we'll talk with Martin Herring, Chief Marketing Officer at Finastra, about the evolving business models they see emerging as a result of open banking and how incumbents need to respond. In the second half, Jane Barrett, Chief Advocacy Officer at MX.com, and I will talk about the human implications of open banking. Today's show is brought to you by Finastra. Finastra is providing the broadest portfolio of financial services software in the world today, spanning retail banking, transaction banking, lending, treasury, and capital markets. Finastra unlocks the potential of people and businesses in finance, creating a platform for open innovation. Provoke Media is the podcast partner for Seamless Middle East, coming up April 10th to 11th in Dubai. Seamless is a dynamic summit and a large-scale exhibition bringing together the converging worlds of e-commerce, retail payments, fintech, and identity. Register at seamless-expo.com. Finally, the Financial Brand Forum runs from April 15th to 17th in Las Vegas. Experience the world's largest and most elite conference on marketing, CX, data analytics, and digital transformation in the banking industry. Get your tickets today at financialbrandforum.com. Have something you want to share with our audience? Hit us on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm.
Very excited to have Martin Herring, the Chief Marketing Officer, who also leads a big part of Finastra's strategic work, to talk about open banking today. And so, Martin, welcome to Breaking Banks. And you're really excited to have you with both a European view and a global view to talk about open banking. So we're a year in since it was mandated. I'd love your thoughts. How have things evolved now that we've actually reached the practical implementation phase? And what's actually changed since the rubber hit the road?
Well, first of all, thanks for being part of the show. I think it was a very exciting year, driven by the regulatory angle of PSD2, issued first in the UK, but now spreading around EU. There is a lot of activity going on where, on the one hand side, banks need to apply to these regulations, so they see it mostly as a threat. But other banks outside of the European Union, especially in Asia, have gone far beyond that and more opening the whole banking infrastructure to allow fintechs and third-party providers to develop completely new business models. So I think there you see some laggards in the banking space. And to be honest, I think a lot of the America's banks are still a bit in the laggard category. And I think really leading is Asia these days.
Well, let's drill into that, because completely agree that you're in the U.S. I'm still shocked the number of banks and bankers that don't even know what PSD2 is. And I don't think they get the existential threat that comes from, you know, both the East and the West that have been forced into this. Well, I guess it's predominantly the West, the European Union and UK, you know, were forced by regulators. But let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Asia and what you're seeing, because they seem to have embraced it on their own rather than by mandate.
Well, I'm just coming off a meeting in Hong Kong where we were at Cyberport, which is an area where the Hong Kong government invested heavily in the last 2-3 years into the fintech community. And the attitude that the large incumbent banks have in Asia is that this open banking trend is a trend that we can't stop. So either we go with the flow or we might not exist going forward. And they feel that because of their legacy infrastructure in the back end, they can't innovate fast enough to drive the right customer experience and the right product portfolio going forward. So they are stuck with legacy infrastructure back end, hard to change. They don't have the innovative mindset. They don't have agile working environments. And therefore, collaboration with fintechs is their way out of the dilemma, not to have the best products and the best customer experience. And therefore, I think it's a great synergy right now in this area that happens, and a big trend that is driven also, I think, by the Asian culture in serving their clients just in a better way.
Yeah. Well, so they have legacy infrastructure for sure, and we'll circle back to that. They also have legacy culture. You know, one thing I want to build on here is they also have legacy business models. And you wrote a great blog post around this. Would love for you to talk a little bit more about how you see the incumbent players adapting from a business model point of view. Because you know, they still have to make money. You know, that's the challenge as an incumbent is your shareholders do actually expect you to continue to make money in this interim period while they're sorting things out. What models do you think you fleshed out for? Maybe you could opine a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. Once a bank decides to open up their infrastructure to outside fintechs, I think you also need to think about not just building the platform for fintechs outside and let them enable new business model. You have to think as a bank, what are your own business models going forward? And I think what you will see going forward are three or four different business model that the bank needs to consider here. I think one of the obvious ones is when you open up your whole banking infrastructure through open banking and open APIs, you can start to sell these APIs to these fintechs. So instead of just giving this for free, why don't you charge fintechs for the access to your banking infrastructure, for the access to your data, for the access to, let's say, credit data to make better credit ratings for these fintechs. If you do payment services for these fintechs, you want to charge that. So instead of selling products to end customers, you are starting to service fintechs through open APIs and charge them. And in that case, your business model is a platform player. So you offer a platform, the platform broadens up, you create more and more APIs that you can sell into this fintech community. The other thing that you could do, which is right now mainly driven in the UK and in EU, is you want to be an aggregator of services. Now, instead of leaving it up to the fintech to aggregate banking information, account information across various banks, why don't you offer this as a bank to your clients? So when you are, for example, a DBS or an HSBC customer, in your HSBC banking app, you can also see your banking account or credit card information from MasterCard, from Deutsche Bank, or for DBS. So you are also an aggregator, and that aggregation drives better customer experience, and so you will be more sticky to your clients. Also, you can bundle third-party services, for example, from insurance companies on top. So as an HSBC customer, you can close an insurance, life insurance, car insurance, through that use of APIs, and the bank connects you finally to that third party. So from that, you get commissions, for example, from reselling third-party services. And therefore, the business model behind this, an aggregation and distribution business model, where I think a bank can make a lot of good business. And I think the last one is, which I also see a trend here in Europe and in Asia, is that large incumbent banks are creating so-called neobanks. So neobanks that are serving a special segment of the market, mostly in the age of 20 to 35, max 40, where people want for free credit cards, they want to pay no fees for their accounts. They want better advice. They want 7x24 accessibility of a branch agent through either video calls or things like that. So where you set up a bank in a bank, but that neobank serves just a very specific client segment, and therefore you might reach people and make your bank more sticky to people that probably would leave you and go to banks like N26 or Monzo or some of these very dedicated neobanks that are popping up right now.
Well, in, you know, let's build on this for a second, because it's interesting. In some of the cases, the banks are actually abdicating the customer relationship to the fintech providers and providing banking as a service. And others are trying to incorporate the those services themselves, whether from other incumbents as bundlers or the fintech startups. And in this last case, you talked about reaching new segments. Do you really think that new segment, the neobank, is that differentiated and can actually be profitable in the delivery, that you can actually build a business case around that? Because for as much touted success as there is around the neobanks, you know, none of them are actually making money yet.
You are absolutely right. So from I would say 90% of the neobanks today are not in a profitable area. But the amount of venture capital funds going into these banks is enormous. And why is this the case? Because, as I said, they are serving a complete new target segment, and banks want to be sticky long term, right? The tendency to leave an incumbent bank to go to a neobank is right now really huge. When I look into the millennial generation, they are switching bank accounts like crazy. They don't have an affinity to a banking brand. The neobank that serves them better, that serves them cheaper, that serves them 7x24 will win in that race. But I think still there is money to make if neobanks are looking at this more intelligent. So it's not just giving a free credit card or a free savings or debit account. It's more about how can I start to cross-sell? How can this neobank, for example, also be an aggregator of services or a consultant where you have chatbots, robo-advisors, wealth management, where you route to other people's products, so you sit on commissions, where you have fee-based incomes, or where you use your money from your accounts and present small loans to your community, so you make your money through interest. So I think the neobanks that will survive in the long run are the ones that aggregate more services, that offer more cross-selling, and expand their portfolio above and beyond just, I would say, offering a credit card and a simple account.
So all of this supposes that banks can actually be better integrated on the back end, that they can unlock the power of the data they sit on and the historical, both business and technological silos. As an incumbent player, you yourself face an innovator's dilemma here, right? You have a large installed existing base, you know, that's very profitable. But how has Finastra approached the call towards open banking, and how do you avoid cannibalizing your existing business? Where do you choose to disrupt versus play defense?
Well, Finastra is a brand that is now in the market for 1.5 years as a merger of Mises and D&H. And I think these were two companies with a very traditional business model, serving the incumbent banks, but also we thought 18 months ago, how do we adopt to that changing ecosystem out there? Gates said, I think in the 90s, banks might disappear, banking will stay. So we thought that the future of banking is really in banking as a service or bank as a platform. And if this is the future of banking, how do we change our software architecture and model to adopt this to this new world? And so what we decided 18 months ago is that we will open up all the software that we have. And right now, Finastra serves 90% of a banking need. We are serving investment banks, treasury and capital markets clients, retail banks, corporate banks. We have payments, lending, As I said, 90% of what a bank needs to drive their operations. And all that software that was previously proprietary, locked, and we sold it in a traditional sales model, is now opened up through open APIs. And all these APIs are exposed through a platform which we call FusionFabric.cloud. And we allow now fintechs to go to this platform and play around with all these APIs to build new apps on top. So it's almost like the Apple iOS. We want to be the Apple iOS of the financial services world and let innovative fintechs play with these APIs and build innovation on top, because we firmly believe that innovation is driven by collaboration. Collaboration between us and fintechs, but finally through the platform, collaboration with incumbent banks and fintechs, because our platform is not just exposing our APIs to fintechs, but also allows banks to connect through our platform through to this fintech ecosystem. So for example, on top of this platform, we built a store. It's called the Fusion Store, and it's simply almost like the Apple App Store, where you go to the store, you see all these financial apps, and you select the ones you want to buy, and then the bank can buy these apps, and we are charging a kind of revenue share of that from the fintech, so very similar to the Apple concept. But on top of that, we are also offering for the fintechs a large developer workbench, where a fintech can log in and immediately start to program apps in that environment using our open APIs. And that kind of model resonates quite nicely with these fintechs, because the biggest problem that fintechs have today is, first of all, getting connection and connectivity to large banks. If a small fintech knocks on the door of a bank, they would not say, oh yeah, we are opening our data center and play around. It is very protective and closed still. So with us, they can immediately access all the core banking infrastructure in the background. Second, we are serving today out of the, I would say, top 12 to 15,000 banks, we are serving 9,000 already. So the fintechs programming on our platform get immediately access to an ecosystem worldwide of 9,000 banks. And third, they get this data infrastructure almost for free, because as long as they are not delivering an app in a commercial way to the store, all the programming on that platform is for free. So getting a free of charge platform, getting access to a large ecosystem, and running on a platform that serves already 9,000 clients out there, I think is a quite attractive spot to be. And this is where we believe we want to make money as Finastra in the future. Our future is really that platform thinking. And I think no other vendor outside.
Break that down for me. I was about to ask, how are you making money? So I'm assuming it's a limited time that they're allowed to access all of this for free. Where does it flip, and how do you charge them, and what are the 9,000 banks? I would think if I'm one of those 9,000 incumbent banks, I'm not sure I'd be willing to give up access to my data and plug into the ecosystem for free. So how does your business model evolve here?
Okay. So I think we need to talk about different persona using that platform. Let's start with the classical fintech developer. That fintech developer will apply for a login into our platform, and that login is for free. And they see all the exposed open APIs that we have. They are trained how to use them. They see what kind of responses they get. So you can compare this a bit like Microsoft's GitHub, right, where you have tons of APIs and tool sets that you can use, and that is for free. Then you program your application, put it on the store, and once it's on the store and they sell it to a bank, we are getting a fair share of that revenue. So it's a revenue share model for the apps that these developers will build. The next thing is the banks that want to participate in that platform. Now, as a bank, you can decide also to participate in the app development, because you, as a bank, you might be a Finastra customer already. You have the latest software running in your data center. You just connect to this platform, and all the fintech apps that are on that store will run immediately also on your infrastructure. And we are charging the banks by the transactions that go through our platform. That is a similar model like Salesforce would use or other SaaS vendors would use, where you charge by transaction load. And it's always up to the bank. If they allow that fintech to connect to their data center and their customer data backend, because all this goes through highly secure APIs, so it is not that all the banks that have access to this platform will expose their APIs to all the fintechs. It is a one-to-one connection, and the banks submit kind of tokens to that fintech, so we can make sure that only that fintech has only access to a certain amount of APIs that this bank will offer. So as I said, it's a combination between transaction load going through our platform plus the revenue share model that we have with fintechs.
So who owns the compliance and regulatory burden here? Because you talked a little bit about the security. Who ultimately has to answer to the regulators if something does go wrong?
So you have to split it in two levels. One is really the data center level. And as you know, we want to focus on software and want to leave it to others to build the data center infrastructure below that. And we have selected a longstanding partnership with Microsoft a year ago, where Microsoft Azure builds the underlying data center infrastructure, so gives us the ability to scale with our platform in all the countries that also we have presence. So it's an exclusive arrangement with Microsoft, and we are using a lot of their technology and infrastructure. And Microsoft is in all these regulatory talks with the in-region regulators when it comes to data privacy, how the data centers are run, compliance talks, and all that. So that is on the data center level. And of course, we are then in talks when it comes to the functionality of our software and making sure that the apps that are built on top apply to certain security standards. So before the fintech can launch or offer that app on the store, it goes through an intense check on our side before they can launch it. It's again similar to what Apple will do on their side, that there's a first check and people cannot just wildly distribute apps. So it's a two-layered approach from us and Microsoft.
So last question here. We'd love for you to share some thoughts. If you're at a bank and beginning to see the seeds of disruption not only are shown but beginning to take root, how should they begin to even think about this and take action when they think about the pressure on them technologically, culturally, business model-wise? Where should they start?
It is funny to say, but in most cases, it has nothing to do with technology. In most cases, it starts with a culture. Do they adopt a culture of innovation? Do they adopt a culture of agility? Do they adopt a culture of putting the customer in the center of everything they do? If that is not the case, technology will not help. So what we see is that a lot of banks, they see the necessity not just to cut on cost. I think cost cutting was a topic probably 10 years ago, but what we see more and more is that banks are losing customers left, right, and center. So being more customer focused, offering better products, offering faster turnaround cycles on new products, be more sticky to the client, know the client, consult the client, being available 7/24 hours for the client. These things are becoming way more crucial going forward. And when it comes to product innovation, they know that most of the banks know that they are not fast enough to develop new products fast enough to serve their clients in the best way. And that's the tipping point where finally, if you have that culture that you go outside and say the new way of innovation is through collaboration with the outside system, with the fintechs, to build better service capabilities towards the clients. But it always starts with a cultural and mind change in the bank and not with an IT-driven approach.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. It all begins with the mindset. Thank you so much for joining us today, Martin, to share your thoughts globally and then from a technology perspective, how banks need to be thinking about the future as it relates to open banking and the coming disruption.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks.
Yeah, and we'll include a link to your great LinkedIn article about the four evolving business models. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And now it's time for a short break. In a few minutes, we'll be back with Penny Crossman of American Banker, and then we'll close the show with Shane Barrett of MX.com. You're listening to Breaking Banks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/voiceamerica.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Exciting second segment of the show with one of my favorite regular contributors, Penny Crossman from American Banker. Penny, thanks for making time in your always busy schedule to talk about open banking. One of the things I love is your candor. Whenever we talk about this, subject of what's happening in the world of innovation, I think you shine a very realistic light. And so when we think about open banking, we're a year in. How much has really changed?
That's a good question. And thank you for saying realism and not pessimism. I don't see a ton of change. We did see BBVA launch its open platform, and it's going to be offering its open banking in the U.S. We've certainly seen Capital One and BBVA, be fairly active with offering APIs to others. We have seen, I would say, a small number of other banks be openly excited about open banking. Radius Bank comes to mind.
Yeah.
A few of the banks that are sort of a utility for other fintechs also do offer quite a bit. So there's some happening, but I think a lot is happening behind the scenes that we can't see. I've heard that a lot of the large banks are doing a lot with open API standards and trying to work pretty hard toward open banking, but not necessarily doing it in the public eye, sort of getting all their I's dotted and T's crossed before they make a lot of public announcements. And of course, we have seen a lot of bilateral agreements over the last few years between banks and, say, accounting software programs. But beyond, a few that really are taking the charge, I can't say that I'm seeing a ton of activity, although there's a lot of talk about it. I think there are a lot of natural obstacles that stand in the way for a lot of U.S. banks, and not necessarily a ton of incentives at this point, other than, you know, wanting to be relevant, wanting to be disruptive or a challenger, wanting to work with innovative fintechs, which are all good reasons to be to be more open.
Well, that does seem like the ones who are making the most, at least visible, forward progress, they're above the waterline, are the ones that are actually changing their business model, that they're looking at being banking as a service in terms of opening their APIs, or being aggregators, to use two of the four models that Martin had talked about in the first segment. But other than the noise they can make with that, what's the long-term incentive to actually open your APIs if you're the existing bank and what you have there?
Well, I think, it kind of depends on the bank and its business. But I think, like, for instance, if you talk to smaller banks like Radius, they have this realization that they have an older customer base and they need to reach millennials. So they have for a while, as you know, they've been partnering with companies like Aspiration and, interesting fintech companies that offer something that's very appealing to millennials. So having a degree of openness lets them have these partnerships and offer their customers these kinds of services and allow the services to easily open new accounts to their customers through that sort of two-way interaction. For larger banks, I think it kind of varies. I feel like the way we saw Wells Fargo start out with this, it was, and Silicon Valley Bank too, it was to offer something to their business clients. Yeah. So their business clients, if Microsoft is your client, they might not like your online banking, so they want to go create their own online banking using your data. So to keep those customers happy, that's how they got started offering APIs. I also think what Wells Fargo's done with Control Tower is kind of interesting, letting consumers see all of the third-party apps that they're actually, connecting their mm-hmm. cards to. It's a little bit different, I guess you could say. But so there are these different little incentives. But I would say in general, as we go down this road of more and more challenger fintech companies becoming more and more successful, like Chime comes to mind. They keep growing very quickly. They have several million customers now. Betterment, Wealthfront, Acorns, Robinhood. There are so many fintechs that are gaining some traction. I think that a lot of banks are realizing they are going to have to go this route to stay relevant, to offer customers what they really want, to kind of meet customers where they're already going, and to be, a real to remain a part of the customer's life as they're sort of continuously cherry-picking these kinds of apps and services that are, a lot of cases a little bit better than what's offered by the traditional bank.
Well, certainly a little bit better in terms of the user experience, but, harkening back to having co-founded one of those first challenger banks in 2008, I can tell you getting someone to actually move their primary banking relationship is much more difficult than having a good user experience. And, I do look at some of these numbers and what the Neo and Challenger banks are putting out right now, and I can say, I can see your customer counts are growing, but what's your actual true utilization growing in proportion to that? Because I wonder how much, Chris Skinner brought this up on the show a couple of weeks ago, that how much of this is people start to pick off point applications, but they're, former anchor might still be their bank, but it actually has kind of become a commodity position now where it's like the router, but you're moving your money into all sorts of other little point applications. Is that maybe one of the outcomes that we're going to see of open banking is, kind of like the iPhone, there's no one dominant software package anymore. I take my phone as a chassis and I load a whole bunch of different applications on it.
Well, I don't really know the answer to that, but I think that does seem to be the direction we're going. And I think we're also seeing that some of the challengers become very aware of that fact that they really want that main customer relationship. And I think we're starting to see them add incentives like higher deposit rates and services that encourage people to keep their primary checking account that they deposit their payroll into with them.
Yeah.
And I think that like even comes to mind where they let you get a little bit of an advance on your next paycheck, you know, things like that where I do think that's a dawning realization that they've got to try to hook people in and offer more than just kind of a pretty budgeting tool or something.
You know, for as much as things change, the more it stays the same. We're still talking about a race to how do I get the direct deposit as the anchor that's going to keep you coming back. And so much of it becomes a rate-based game again.
Yes, I think that's probably true. But yeah, I think it's still, the banks, the scale, as you were saying, they still have most of the primary relationships. And they are, you know, they are catching up a little bit with their own offerings. You know, several banks now have sort of a separate digital brand or, you know, they're really beefing up their digital offerings to be quite a bit more competitive. You know, there's more banks offering budgeting and savings help and, you know, what's safe to spend and kind of borrowing a lot of the ideas that the fintechs came up with.
Yeah.
So they are trying on their own, but I think I think some of them do still recognize the need for open banking and that need to be part of the broader ecosystem.
Well,
but it's slow.
I think it's slower than all would have expected. And maybe in summary, would say it feels like we're still at the infancy, and it's very uncertain the direction this goes. You know, what closing thoughts do you have for us as we think about the future of open banking?
Well, I mean, I do think it probably sounds trite, but it does seem like the banks and the companies that move ahead and experiment and are proactive will have an edge and do have an edge, and you know that will be recognized by their customers. And I also think, you know, it behooves the core vendors to really make an effort to try to help some of their customers, especially those that have very old core systems, because that's one of the key obstacles. You know, help them with their aging infrastructure, help them figure out a path toward being more open so that, you know, as things move in this direction, they don't get left behind.
You're absolutely right that either your core infrastructure becomes a force multiplier for you or it becomes an anchor around your feet that you're never going to keep up if you're dragging them behind you. Well,
yeah, that's true.
Thank you very much for joining us. As always, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, Penny, and we'll probably be in touch another week or two.
Sure. Thank you, Jason.
Welcome back to another episode of Breaking Banks as we continue the discussion around open banking. And excited to have Jane Barrett, the head of, what is your new title? Your chief evangelist?
Chief Advocacy Officer.
Advocacy officer. Man, normally when I see a CAO, I think chief accounting officer. Mm-hmm, so advocacy
exactly.
Sounds a lot better. But at MX, and you know, excited to talk. MX has been an early player before open banking was a thing. And so, Jane, before we kick off, why don't you tell a little bit first about what MX does, you know, from its evolution from Money Desktop to where it is today, and then what your role is there.
Sure. Well, so first, thank you for having me on. It's great to be here. MX was founded with a mission around empowering the world to be financially strong and, you know, a vision of finances as they should be. And this was back from way in the early days of Money Desktop, where it was tools and data to visualize and plan your financial life. So when you think about just how far the industry has evolved in terms of being able to get a great consolidated view of finances, get contextual advice, it really hasn't come that far. MX has definitely been at the forefront of using data to drive great outcomes. So MX brings in data, aggregates, cleans, categorizes, makes what raw data out of financial institutions into something that's very usable and actionable for humans, and then also have a suite of tools around personal finance, everything from budgeting but through to things like cash flow management, debt reduction, just how you can visualize much more scenarios in your financial life, as well as working with financial institutions around just how to better categorize their own customers to be able to service them better. So getting great insights on the data. So if you think about, you know, the umbrella is financial data, but it's very much focused on improving outcomes for the customers of financial institutions.
Now, when you and I were talking about this, and I had asked the question of the why behind this, and you responded with the word goodness. And you know, goodness, like innovation and friendliness, are things that in general people go, yes, goodness is a good thing. And everyone, I think, assumes they understand a definition. But if you were to ask probably 10 people, you get 15 different answers. You have a very specific definition of goodness that I think is worth sharing as the why behind both MX and when we talk about open banking and does it drive goodness, that I think it's worth getting people on the same page.
For sure. So, I mean, definitely this good idea of goodness exists on two fronts. If you can drive healthy outcomes for your customers, you will improve their financial lives. That's a great outcome for, again, for humans. But it's also a great outcome for financial institutions. I think there has been so much effort and so much money put into financial literacy programs, financial health programs, financial wellness programs. They haven't really been tied to specific business outcomes. And, you know, as any executive would know, at the end of the day, it's good if it works. It's good if there's a return to a company. And if you think about just what a good outcome looks like for people, you know, if you can help people increase the savings, you know, maybe they've got high interest debt, maybe they're working with payday lenders. If you can, like, start to move behavior towards healthier behavior. So, okay, now we're going to increase everyone's savings as a goal, you know, to have everyone's got $400 emergency savings in their account as a business outcome. As a human outcome, that's a great business outcome because your deposits have gone up. If you have a goal of reducing outflows to payday lenders by offering lower cost or lower interest rate loans, then, you know, you're bringing that back into the institution, but it could have a profound impact on the monthly outflows for your customers. So I think there is this idea of, you know, goodness from both the consumer perspective as well as the company perspective, to be able to say, you know, you do the right thing by your customer, it will pay off from an ROI perspective to the company. And it's not a bunch of blog posts saying that, you know, we care about your financial health. It's taking action and providing tools and giving contextual advice. And I think there's a huge promise within open banking to be able to do that. You know, you can't give someone great contextual advice if you don't know who they are.
Well, so let's pull on that thread for a second, because so much of the conversation around open banking is about, you know, technologically, how do you do it, in particular with cores that are really built like castles with high walls and moats around them, and the policy fact that's driving it. But we don't often talk about the why. So when you think of open banking, you know, is there goodness in open banking? Where does that sit?
I think this is like one of the biggest opportunities that the financial services industry has had in a very long time. So a lot of the conversation around open banking has been this idea of almost like monodirectional data flow. We're going to take data from your financial institution, flow it into some fintech, and there'll be a magical outcome for a human. That is such a limited view of what open banking can do. Like, number one, data flows both ways. So institutions who are ahead of the curve and are pulling in data from all different sources have a massive both advantage and opportunity to be that primary financial services provider to a customer, because I now have a 360 view of your finances. And, you know, this doesn't even need to be a, you know, a traditional bank or credit union. This could be an investment house. You know, it could be an insurance company. Anyone who says, you know, I care about your financial health, we're going to look to tools and advice that's going to help move your financial life forward. Connect your different accounts, right? Connect your retirement account, connect your investment account, connect you know, any multitude of credit card or savings or checking accounts. And then all of a sudden, once you've got that data set and you can sort of look at it in a way that is clean and actionable, like that is where the opportunity begins. Just presenting it back in, you know, a couple of pie charts, you know, that's a great first step. But there's so, so much more that can be done. And I think that opportunity of, you know, step one, a consolidated view of your finances that's clean and actionable is absolutely huge.
Well, and I think the actionable piece is one of the hardest parts because, you know, first, research shows that finances are the number one source of stress in, mm-hmm. at least in most Americans' lives, and I think that extends at least through most of the rest of the world. It's also cited as the number one cause of divorce, yet people are so scared of it, they run away from mm-hmm. it. How do you actually turn around and move the needle in someone's life to make it actionable in a way that it, you know, either changes behaviors or they do things in a better and different way?
Mm-hmm. So there is no silver bullet. And if there was, it would have been implemented a long time ago. But starting with a set of tools, and I mean, it also depends what services you offer. I think investment advisors have had an advantage over the years because they have been able to look at, you know, as close to 360 view of data and actually sit down with a customer and sort of talk through, you know, not just the financial, but it's the psychological side of money, the family pressures, you know, what's going on in your life at that moment in time. And there are financial planning programs that are getting closer to that experience. But I guarantee within, you know, 3 to 5 years and certainly moving further out with, you know, the advance of machine learning and really being able to get much more specific around what advice to give when. Like mm-hmm. that is how you move the needle. And I mean, even products that can look into your current behavior and benchmark you against your peers or against someone in your zip code or against, you know, a group that you self-identify. I may not identify against my peers or my zip code. So at least to know that, you know, I outspent my neighborhood by 20% on gifts in December, right? It's like, yikes. Okay, that's a really great stat to know. So and even like those little things can nudge you forward in terms of, okay, I need to be more, you know, more careful or maybe save for my holiday gifts next year and not just put them all on the credit card.
When ComEd, you know, shows me my average energy usage versus my neighbors and then versus my energy efficient neighbors, it not only sparks a conversation in the Hendricks household, it drives some changes in behaviors mm-hmm. and a lot more sweatshirts are being worn mm-hmm. Versus the thermostat going up. But, you know, you bring up an interesting aspect. This idea of open banking doesn't just open up your data to the institution to give you better recommendations. It actually gives you a lot more visibility against a lot of other peer sets in mm-hmm. a very important way, because if you look at its surface, you know, everyone's driving a fancy car and is having, you know, fancy clothes, and we don't see that underlying debt that can be sitting below them. I hadn't thought about, you know, open banking widens the data set and is going to allow you to see more of that.
It's very true. And I think, I mean, it is a complex policy discussion, especially when you get into privacy and what constitutes your personal data and what's de-identified data and who owns that. And, you know, as Amex, we are very much in the camp of individuals own their data and, you know, the ecosystem needs to be trusted custodians of that data. But I think that is a, you know, that's a massive shift from previous where, you know, companies, not just financial institutions, all companies would use personal data basically just to sell their customers more stuff. Right. That's what data was for. We're gonna segment this and dice and slice it and just figure out where our most profitable customers are and sell there versus how do we really turn that around?
To challenge you on that, have we really moved that far beyond that Wells Fargo, you know, where we get lost in this? Because when we talk about this idea of, you know, driving better behaviors and goodness, I think banks naturally fall into this trap where they think of that as, I need to get them into another product. It's more product, mm-hmm. it's more product. You know, how does a bank actually think of the ROI of, you know, this better choices and literacy and goodness if it isn't, you know, a marketing expense or leading to more products?
So it's a deeply cultural thing first. and then probably structural second, and then setting things like ROI goals third. I mean, I'm with the Patriot Bootcamp today, something that USAA has been a partner to and supporter of for many, many years. Like, is someone sitting at USAA saying, what's the ROI of this? Of course not. Right? This is something that is deeply cultural to their business. And I think when you have that sensibility around we will do what is right for our customers, we'll do what's right for our community, then structure can change, right? Then it's like, okay, so we don't just say we put the customer in the middle of our org chart. The customer genuinely is, you know, on a cultural level, the most important thing that we come to work for every day. I think from it's a great question around ROI. There's even just picking a single data point and setting a baseline, like it could feel like boiling the ocean. And I'm sure there's a lot of institutional scar tissue around past literacy programs that didn't produce ROI. But if you could pick a baseline data element, and it could be something like emergency savings. You know, we want everyone in our community to have X amount of emergency savings, and we're going to give the tools, whether it is, you know, rounding up on purchases, whether it's setting a direct deposit every month, but we're going to give the tools to help that happen. Like, you can start with that. It doesn't have to be the we're going to wave our magic wand and now we're going to all be magically focused on healthy outcomes, because of course getting products that will help, you know, the institution move forward is always going to be an objective. This is just doing it through a very different lens. And, you know, very cynically, you know, financial health has been used as a marketing ploy for a long time. And I say that with love as a marketer at heart. But, you know, it is very easy to say we really care about you and this is all about outcomes. And then, you know, you actually scratch the surface and say, well, how are you doing that? And it usually comes down to, well, we've got all these products and that's what helps people. It's like, well, everyone's got those products. You're a big old commodity if all you're doing is selling products.
Well, but let's face it, the reality, if you look at the majority of U.S. banks, if you looked at their websites without the brands on it, they're 99% the same because that's how they approach the world. And I think that's going to start to change in the EU where open banking was mandated. This idea that now the customer can move their data and can move their relationships very easily, they're going to be able to assess a lot more quickly who's actually providing me value, and the friction's been taken out of it, which is going to, I think, lead maybe not mass exodus, but for some significant changes in where customers choose to bank based on that value you're talking about. It almost becomes the mandate when everything else has become commodity.
Yeah, and it's an interesting sort of philosophical discussion in that anyone who has been, you know, as the verb, aggregating their data and sharing it with third parties and getting a different view and putting it together, people who are actively looking at their money that way, this is like a very small conceptual leap. Oh, I can port it anywhere. I have the right to be forgotten. I can turn access on and off. Like, it's that much more I'm now actively driving my financial life. And I basically could put together my own digital bank with, you know, six different service providers, and none of them could be the primary financial institution. It could be an app. So there is, and I think, you know, the early fintechs definitely showed the way for how that can work. There's enormous opportunity and upside for financial institutions to adopt more of those practices in terms of, you know, what is that experience? The experience isn't clicking from one button to the next in a usable way. The experience is solving problems and meeting needs and, you know, meeting customers where they are. You know, I don't look like every other middle-aged mom out there, but I'm treated like it, and it makes me crazy.
Yeah. Well, so as we're out of time, if you're a financial institution that hasn't started thinking about open banking, where should they start? Because it is a sea, and as you mentioned, it could be boiling the ocean.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, starting with where you are with your own customer data, right? And most bigger institutions, of course, are holding it themselves or working with large providers. Sometimes the mid-sized and smaller institutions are working with their core banking providers. But where, you know, what are you actually doing now? Because I think there is a sense of, you know, open banking is something that we can figure out in the future or we can opt into later. But it's already happening. It's just not happening in the most secure of way. Data, like screen scraping, has been around for 20 years. So your data is leaving the institution and the customer credentials are out there. Like, this shift is one that is, you know, it's non-negotiable. Like you should be doing the right thing by customers by moving to, you know, less credential sharing and more token-based data sharing. Immediate, you know, privacy gains, security gains, and cost reduction from, you know, scrapers hitting the website over and over. So there is like a business reason, there's a security reason to consider, but just where are you now is step one. Learning from what's happened in other markets is somewhat of a first step. I think for US institutions especially, it is infinitely more complex here. There's a much bigger data set that's been taken on than, say, in the UK. There is a steep learning curve. One thing I would recommend against is just kind of outsourcing it to a technology team to figure out, because it would be a massive, again, strategic missed opportunity to say, what data should we be getting in? What should we be, you know, encouraging our customers to share with us so we can get to know them better, right? That is sort of the mindset to start with, in that this is a great thing because we can learn so much more and provide a higher level of service.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And, you know, thank you for being in Austin, working with Patriot Bootcamp. Our veterans are lucky to have you as they're starting to explore their own entrepreneurial journey. You know, folks should definitely check out the mx.com blog. And Jay, you have a ton of material out there yourself. Where can they find you on LinkedIn as institutions and individuals are looking to learn about financial health?
So I have courses on LinkedIn Learning. They're everything from how to ask for a raise to what's a margin account, should I get one, on the personal side. I also have small business financial health, which is an area which often does get overlooked. We talk about, you know, people all the time, but, you know, small businesses are the biggest employers, and it often gets overlooked. So LinkedIn Learning is a great place for, you know, just to really dig in on the personal and the small business financial learning.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your visit to Patriot Bootcamp to share with us today. Jane Barrett at MX.com.
Thank you, Jason.
Special thanks to Finastra for sponsoring today's show. Finastra, providing the broadest portfolio of financial services software in the world today, spanning retail banking, transaction banking, lending, treasury, and capital markets. Finastra unlocks the potential of people and businesses in finance, creating a platform for open innovation. Thanks to our guests this week, Martin Herring from Finastra and Jane Barrett from MX.com. Read both of their work on LinkedIn. Martin has an excellent piece on business model implications of open banking, and Jane regularly discusses all sorts of implications of financial literacy and financial wellness. Also thanks to regular contributor Penny Crossman from American Banker. Have something to say about today's show or ideas for future shows? Reach out at BreakingBanks1 on Twitter or email us at info@provoke.fm. I know we say this every week, but if you like the show, the best way you can support us is take a minute to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That's all for this week's show. Happy Valentine's Day, and talk to you next week on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.